Yes, we will.
Ty, I tell you.
I'd like to have more members. Here. Christy, you ready? Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for attending today to the House Revenue Committee. Today is the 24th of February, and it's just a minute after 1 o'clock. It's time for us to start. We're going to go ahead and hear a number of issues today relative to tax fairness and tax compliance, voluntary compliance, and Oregon's taxation system. In that regard, we do have enough folks here to go ahead and open a regular committee. I'd like to move to a work session as soon as we possibly could with regard to 2127, House Bill 2127. But I would like to have more members here so that you'll all have opportunities to vote on this. If not, Representative Berger will hold the record open and allow everyone to vote on it. I also need to be excused midway through the House Committee on Audit is meeting with another Senate committee up in Portland this afternoon. So we do have Representative McPherson here. Representative McPherson is in on 24.
We're down to two.
Okay. So let me do this. We're going to go ahead and we're just short a couple members.
Andy's right behind me.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's do this. Representative McPherson, if it's all right, we're going to go ahead and take care of some other business. And so I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2127.
Mr. Chair.
Naz, welcome back. It's nice to have you here and well again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's really ironic that I'm back here just when I missed this bill. Remember, this was heard on February
13th.
And as I was working home on Sunday on February 13th on this bill, I kind of felt faint and I had to go to the hospital. So we'll call this bill that went sent Mel's into the hospital bill.
That's the only bad omen with regard to this, and it's all over now.
Yes. The good thing is it's back when I am back. House Bill 2127.
Okay.
To refresh your memory, Elizabeth did this while I was gone, and look into employment insurance payroll taxes. And this bill basically does four major things, and those four major things is allow for a lower tax rate for the new employers, and in the same time adjusting the tax or the unemployment insurance fund to allow for a lower percentage of insured unemployment from 7% to 5.6%. This basically gives the biggest bang for the buck, if you will. And the other things is allowing the reserve fund that exists today, it's about $234 million, to be used into payments of benefits and exhausting that fund while shifting the programs, employment programs that are using the interest on this fund into a new dedication of the rate of 0.09 on the new rates. And because of all of these, we will be able to go to a lower schedule of allowing the funds to accumulate at, and that will also bring reductions in the amounts of employment taxes that will be levied on employers. Now, you probably last time have seen a revenue impact statement, and this is as far as the what you would term as the static impact on the other funds, these being the unemployment insurance tax funds. However, there would be other impacts as part of the dynamic transfer in the economy, if you will. And those primarily come from the fact that when you lower taxes on one factor of production, not to talk too much economics, but the factor of production being employment in this, and you're taxing employment less, there will be a new shock to the system, or an injection of new money to businesses, and that in effect will translate into higher employment at certain time and higher profits that might generate new taxes, and then at the same time the use of those might be also translating to property investments and higher property taxes. Those effects are not figured into the impact yet. Those, what would do is increase the amounts of funds and probably general funds that comes in, and they need to be worked into the system, our OTEM model.
Mezen, you're working off of a February 24th revenue impact. Is there a copy of a revenue impact, a later impact? I noticed the numbers on the bottom of your revenue impact are different than those that were handed out to us on February the 15th.
No, Mr. Chair, they're the same numbers I just had. Because I changed the fonts and things, and just pushed them down.
Oh, I'm sorry. So it's just going to the second page. Okay, all right.
And it's just a good way to keep everything going the right way, I guess.
So that you can read it. That's what you've done. Well, we'll make sure that when this is carried on the bill that you print it another time on 8 sheets rather than 3.
So, again, as I have, but I haven't worked those ones that I've talked about, because those would be
so there's no dynamic forecasting that's been done with regard to this. It's pretty much static, and that's just the effect immediately to employment relative to the fund.
That's correct.
Okay. Colleagues, my list of the accomplishments of House Bill 2127 are fivefold. By adjusting the formula, you adjust the formula down and that determines then the balance of the trust fund, the insurance trust fund, reducing the employer rates for new employers entering into the system. The third was to assist in the rounding, to give a more solid effect in the rounding. The fourth was to spend down the benefit reserve fund while building up the trust fund for the benefit of compensation. And finally, stabilizing of the funding of business services, the CDAF portion of the bill. Is that your recollection? Have I summarized it? Colleagues, we're in a work session. Representative Berger now moves that House Bill 2127 moves to the full House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? Any discussion?
Yes.
Representative Belquist.
No, you're so dumbfounded. I'm asking a question.
You say Boquist. If you've got a question about what this does, go ahead, please.
Actually, no, Mr. Chair. You said discussion, and I support the bill. I don't have any problem with the conceptual idea of it. I still have concerns that I think ought to be addressed as to the performance measures related to the CDAF, and of course, the Employment Department was very gracious and timely to get us the answers to questions that were brought up here. However, I would still have to say, a presentation to Ways and Means that might not necessarily mean we know the information, and some of the performance measures that are in there I still have questions about. However, that is not reflective of this bill, and at a later time I would like the committee to come back and look at that, or at least be cognizant of the fact of what those performance standards we are that we're funding.
And I just want to confirm with the director, Lincoln, it will be heard in general government ways and means, or is this in transportation and economic development, your bill? Okay, transportation and economic development, which would be... Right, but your budget, transportation and economic development, and that would be Representative Greg Smith would be the person with whom that could be brought up. Thank you, Representative Boquist. Further discussion? Colleagues, any objections to moving House Bill 2127 to the floor with a due pass recommendation? Hearing and seeing no objections, that we have a full quorum today. All members are present. We will move House Bill 2127 of the full House with a due pass recommendation. I will assign that to Representative Vicki Berger to carry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We will now close the work session on House Bill 2127. Thank you, Mayor. We'll open public hearings on House Bills 2486, 2487, and 2455. Paul, we're going to do all three of those, and we have Representative Greg McPherson with us. Representative McPherson, please come forward, and staff will start us off.
Mr. Chair, I have some background material, but we can go through that after Representative McPherson's gone through the bill.
Why don't we let Ms. Representative McPherson go through first?
Mr. Chair, would like me to make a presentation here on the bills, the first two bills here, and then the staff will offer comments.
Okay. Let's do that.
Okay. For the record, I'm Representative Greg McPherson, House District 38, and I'm here to present on House Bill 2486 and 2487, which are two bills that I'm the chief sponsor of. And they are the result of some analysis that I had done over the interim to improve income tax compliance in Oregon. Our income tax system in Oregon depends on broad support. We all use public services, and those public services mainly rely on the income tax on a statewide basis for their support. And most of us pay into that system to support those services, but some don't. And that's not fair. It's not fair to working Oregonians who pay quite reliably through the wage withholding system. Anyone who's employed has their income tax held out at the source by their employer, and then they generally get a modest refund back at the end of the year. But sources of income that are not subject to the wage withholding system don't pay with that same reliability, and these two bills are really aimed at that reality. We need to do a better job of collecting the taxes that are already owed. These are not proposals to increase taxes on anyone. They're just to do a better job of collecting what's owed now. The first of the two bills, House Bill 2486, focuses on abusive tax shelters. Now, what is an abusive tax shelter? It's a gimmick. It's a scheme that is developed by someone to offer a plausible or arguable basis for not paying income taxes. The example that I trot out from my own experience in professional work, I'm a lawyer working in the employee benefits field, is an idea that was being shopped around quite a bit here 5 to 10 years ago relating to 401k plans, and was offered up to the employers of 401k plans. And the argument was that by changing the plan year of a 401k plan that was already operating on a calendar year, with an employer also paying its taxes on a calendar year, that if one changed the plan year of that 401k plan to December 30, one year day shy of the employer's taxable year, that it allowed the employer to deduct all the contributions that were being paid in by employees over the next several months in the following year, thereby accelerating by 1 year the date of the employer's deduction. It didn't work, by the way. I mean, the IRS eventually ruled against it, but even after they issued a ruling saying that it didn't work, it was still being shopped around by promoters of tax shelters. These promoters will approach individuals and businesses and say that if they have an idea that's available that will reduce their tax bill, and they'll share the idea only after the individual or business signs a confidentiality agreement and agrees to pay some percentage of the additional write-off that they get in the first year or first several years. Responsible businesses that encounter these kinds of proposals then send them to their other advisors, for example, the law firm that I work at, to have them analyzed, and then we'll advise that, no, it doesn't work oftentimes. But the concern is about all those businesses that are offered up those ideas and don't do the responsible thing and get independent advice and just forge ahead based on what are sometimes rather thin assurances that that the scheme or gimmick actually is a valid reduction in tax. House Bill 2486 is designed to address abusive tax shelters, and it's patterned on a program that was developed in California and was quite successful last year. It identifies a category of tax shelter that's a listed transaction that is listed by the Internal Revenue Service as an abusive tax shelter, or there's authority here for the Oregon Department of Revenue to establish additional listed transactions. There's a registration program for sellers of listed transactions. There's an extra penalty of 20% of the tax avoided by a listed transaction unless the taxpayer has a reasonable belief that it's valid. That goes to 40% if it's a gross valuation misstatement or non-economic substance transaction. That's what happens to the taxpayer who uses the abusive tax shelter. There's also a penalty of 100% of the income derived by a promoter, by a seller, a person who's out pitching these abusive tax shelters to the people who use them. So they, in effect, can be penalized up to 100% of the income that they gain from it. Because the statute of limitations is the safe haven behind which these sellers of abusive tax shelters hide, this bill would extend the statute of limitations for collecting taxes in Oregon. It's currently 3 years or 5 years under certain circumstances, and it would be extended to 6 years for abusive tax avoidance transactions. The main purpose of this bill is to establish fairness, to give assurance to working Oregonians that other people who owe income taxes will pay them. But it should generate additional revenue as well. And in California, actually, the experience was surprisingly favorable. They have used an amnesty program, which is also a feature of this bill, a temporary amnesty program under which the taxpayer who owes additional tax they avoided that tax initially by using an abusive tax shelter would be allowed to come in within a narrow several month period and offer up the tax that they owed and thereby avoid the additional penalties that are being imposed by this bill, not the interest and penalties that would otherwise apply, but the additional enhanced penalties that this bill would impose. Now, I might say, just generally, I'm not a person who's particularly a fan of tax amnesties, because to some extent they operate by convincing people to come forward and pay taxes that they were eventually going to pay anyway. And sometimes we can give up too much in the way we design an amnesty program. But I think, as used in this narrow situation, that is for abusive tax shelters, it can be quite effective. In California, their amnesty period filings, I believe the number is $1.4 billion, that's with a B, was paid in during that amnesty period. Now, I'm not suggesting that we're going to realize anything like that kind of revenue here in Oregon, both because their economy is 10 times the size of ours, and because they had a particularly dynamic situation with the dot-com bubble that occurred at the end of the 1990s, and people who were using these techniques to avoid major capital gains liabilities. But even if it were a fraction of their experience, it could well justify itself. So it's something that I think we definitely need to look at, because we had sort of an echo of that dot-com bubble occurring here in Oregon. We had people who were experiencing significant capital gains and were no doubt taking advantage of various techniques to limit their tax liability. And the years that they would have used those in the end of the 1990s and year 2000 are going to pass into what are going to become closed years, as people say in the tax field, that is no longer subject to assessment of tax because the statute of limitations will have run. So there's an opportunity for us now in Oregon to act on, in this area, lengthen the statute of limitations, crack down on this activity, and thereby derive some additional revenue. And regardless of what additional revenue we collect, provide greater assurance to Oregonians that everybody's pulling their load. I could pause for a moment since I was going to move on to talk about the other bill now and entertain any questions you had on that, or I could move on.
Thank you. That was House Bill 2486. Representative Berger, I know that you're mentioned as a co-sponsor. Would you like to weigh in on this or make any kind of a presentation?
Not at this time. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am on this bill, but this is the brainchild of Representative McPherson, and he speaks far more eloquently than I can. My name is on this, but the credit belongs down there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Berger is very kind, and I appreciate her the confidence that she's shown in this work by lending her name to the effort, which is a name that will, I think, carry some weight.
Okay. Dr. Warner, do you have comments specific to this bill, or do you want to go wait for Representative McPherson's testimony on 2487?
Mr. Chair, I just have some material relating really to the Voluntary Compliance Initiative and to the General Amnesty Program, which is not part of this bill but part of 2455, and also the California experience. So okay. I would be fine to go ahead and move ahead to 2487.
Okay, why don't we do that then if you're on a schedule, Representative McPherson?
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2487 is in the same theme with 2486 because it focuses again on collecting income taxes in Oregon that are due under current law. It is an assortment of several ideas that I've developed that I think are all in aid of that general theme. The first of them is one that arises in my area of practice relating to retirement plans. There are certain retirement distributions from employer-sponsored retirement plans, like 401k plans, that are subject to a mandatory income tax withholding rule for federal income tax purposes, but an optional income tax withholding rule for Oregon income tax. And it is generally it's lump sum distributions as opposed to annuities or installments that are spread out over lifetime or an extended number of years. And it's really just, I think, a quirk in the law that Oregon doesn't follow the federal rule. The federal rule is that if you roll over that distribution, roll over being a technical term in the tax code, it's rolled over directly into an individual retirement account. There's no withholding because that's a tax-free transaction. And the same is true under Oregon law. But if it's not directly rolled over, then under federal income tax law, 20% in federal income tax withholding is mandatory, whereas the withholding of Oregon income tax is optional. And this would simply align Oregon income tax law with federal income tax law so that people have that withholding applied at the source. And I think it should enhance revenue because there are some people who are receiving a lump sum distribution and retiring out of state. And if they've left the state by the time they get that tax return is due, they might forget to pay the tax back in Oregon. And if we've held back the Oregon income tax, they're less likely to forget. There's another withholding idea in here as well, which is withholding of income tax on the gain, the capital gain, on real estate transactions, real estate that's located in Oregon, but where the owner is not an Oregon resident. And that may surprise some people to learn that that's subject to Oregon income tax, but because the gain, the appreciation and the value of that property occurred in Oregon, Oregon can and does tax that gain. Again, there is the risk that people who are located out of state, they get the proceeds paid to them out of escrow, and they owe an Oregon income tax, but it really takes an affirmative act on their part to file that return and send the tax into Oregon. And I think that it would be appropriate for Oregon to do what a number of other states have done, which is to have a withholding rule at the source, so that the dollars are collected out of escrow. The withholding is paid out of escrow. And if there's not tax owed, then that owner can get a refund. But we've got withholding of an amount that is aimed at assuring that compliance. Now, there is the challenge when you're talking about real estate capital gains that sometimes the property may have been held for a long time. It's mostly gain. Other times it may have been held for a very short time, so only a modest portion of its gain. What this bill does is it's patterned on the statute in Colorado, which applies the tax to a percentage of the total sale price or the net proceeds payable out of escrow, whichever is less. So nobody would ever have to pony up money out of pocket to meet the withholding. It's just something that gets paid out of the closing escrow. And the amount I fixed on here in the bill is 4% or net proceeds out of escrow, whichever is less. There are exceptions. It would not apply to transactions with a sale price of under $100,000 on the theory that it's not of a magnitude that is maybe worthwhile trying to impose that kind of a burden on the process of the transaction. That also follows what the state of Colorado does. And there is also an exception for instances where the owner is a resident of the state. So it is aimed at withholding from sales by non-residents of the state of Oregon. The next idea in the bill is to have the Oregon Department of Revenue assist local governments in the collection of their local income taxes to the extent that they enact them. And it's derived in part out of the experience in Multnomah County, where they used a separate collection process, that is, a separate filing was to be made by taxpayers of the local so-called ITAX in Multnomah County. While I've heard a mix of reports about the level of compliance, I have to imagine that the compliance level is substantially lower than it is for Oregon personal income tax, simply because of lack of information, people not realizing that they need to affirmatively make that filing that they were not accustomed to making. So what this idea within the bill would do is provide that local governments it's optional, it's not mandatory, but they can ask the Department of Revenue to handle the administration and collection of the tax for local income taxes that are based on the same definition of taxable income as the Oregon personal income tax. And that's critical because that means it's just a one-line item on the Oregon Form 40, local income tax surcharge or additional tax, whatever it might be. And that it also has to be based on place of residence, because you might have a situation if we evolved to a situation where we multiple jurisdictions, some of them overlapping, using local income taxes. You could have a situation where somebody was resided in a county that had a countywide income tax, and then some of those people resided in a city that had some modest income tax, and other people lived outside of that city. So it's based on place of residence, and it's limited to an aggregate amount of 1% of taxable income. So there's a cap on the total amount involved here, because the work of the Department of Revenue could get substantially more challenging if we were looking at a tax burden that was much larger than the regular Oregon income tax. So this is simply helping assure that to the extent that our local governments use the taxing authority they already have to apply local income tax to their residents, that there is an efficient mechanism for enabling the collection of that tax efficiently. Then the last of the ideas in this bill is to authorize agencies of the state that issue licenses for professional and occupational functions or activities to require a demonstration of compliance by the holders of those licenses with the income tax laws as a condition for receiving initial issuance or renewal of their license. If we're going to establish a valuable privilege to Oregonians to undertake a profession or an occupation that for which a license should be necessary, the idea is those people using that privilege should meet their obligation to support public services generally within the state. Again, this does not require action by the licensing boards. It authorizes action, and what's contemplated is that the Department of Revenue would probably do a pilot program working with one or two or three agencies initially to do cross-checking with to make sure that license holders, in fact, are have been demonstrated to be paying their income taxes, and like maybe a matching process of their Social Security number with the payment of tax or the filing of tax returns, and based on how effective that is at improving compliance, then the program could be expanded into more agencies. But it doesn't require all agencies to do anything in particular. It creates authority for them to act. That is a kind of a once-over a range of ideas, and I realize there's quite a bit of complexity there. But I'm available now, or if you have questions at some later time, too, I'd be happy to sit down with any one of you to talk about any questions you might have on this.
Questions for Representative McPherson on House Bill 2486 or 2487? Representative Riley.
Thank you. Representative McPherson, on the real estate by out-of-state owner, that portion,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't it be easier or just as easy to take that withholding from all transactions instead of just where the owners are out-of-state? Wouldn't it make it easier to have it done one way instead of looking to see where the owner lives?
Chair Haas, Representative Riley, it would be greatly expanding the number of transactions that would be subject to this process if you were to apply withholding to all transactions. And, of course, the great majority of transactions are going to be residential real estate, you know, owner-occupied residential real estate. And generally, the exemptions from tax under the federal tax code that we follow here in Oregon as a general matter are going to be such that no income tax is going to be owed on them. So we certainly wouldn't want to burden the sort of the normal flow of residential sales of homes with this kind of process. This is aimed at a fairly narrow range of activity, and it would probably it would be based on a trigger of a declaration by the individual as to their place of residence and whether they're selling their principal residence. And if they were, then that would just be outside of this process. But it would require some kind of a declaration that they would have to make to the escrow agent that would then put this in motion.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, if you would, Mr. Chair. First, Representative McPherson, on 2487, in the last section you described was the section regarding agencies requiring or having the option to require proof of taxes paid. How did you envision that? I mean, other than creating double-checking standards, had you originally envisioned they provide a copy of their tax return, or without creating more bureaucracy that might not net revenue, my immediate concern or your thought process is, what about the revenue impact of all these agencies now double checking with revenue department, triple checking, yeah, so on and so forth?
Chair Haas, Representative Boquist, a very good question. And I think, sort of in a general theme, one thing that we need to be careful about anything we do that's aimed at trying to improve compliance with our tax laws is that we don't spend more in the process than what we gain. And I think any of these should be put to that kind of test. In this area here, that's why it creates authorization without requiring things to be done. I'm pretty leery of telling our state agencies that we already demand a lot of about new things they have to do unless there's a compelling reason to do it. So this creates an authority. And as I indicated, what's contemplated is that there would probably be a pilot program that would focus rather narrowly on maybe the one agency or a couple of agencies that seem like the best prospects. And what it probably would involve is getting tax identification numbers from the license applicants and then doing a comparison of that with the income tax returns that are on file, to just to make sure that people are paying or are filing some kind of return, and that in itself may have a significant encouraging effect for our licensed individuals to know that that by having sought a state license to conduct their trade, that they're going to be subjecting themselves to a level of scrutiny about whether they've at least put themselves on file.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair. Another talking personal income tax collection by the Department of Revenue. Do you envision, you have some examples other than, I think it's Multnomah County that has this. Is there other entities you're aware of that contemplate this, or... Because I noticed it's very narrowly defined as, you know, income tax, personal income tax.
Right. Chair Hass, Representative Boquist, the theme of both of these bills is improving income tax compliance, because it is the revenue source that we depend on most heavily in the state for the broad range of services. This is not based on any one jurisdiction having approached me and having said, boy, we're thinking of an income tax and we'd like to do this. And in fact, and certainly not from Multnomah County, and in fact, if you notice the numbers, the 1% of income limitation is less than the current level of the iTaxes in Multnomah County. So this is not designed to fit with that tax necessarily. This is really a reaction to that experience and seeing what could happen generally in the state, is that we have a number of jurisdictions that have income taxing authority. And frankly, to have each of those jurisdictions creating its own form and then going after its own citizens, its own residents, to collect that tax is nuts. Mm-hmm. When you have, just as we do piggyback our Oregon personal income tax on the federal income tax, so we should, to the extent that we do local income taxes, and that's a separate policy debate apart from this bill. It doesn't create any new taxing authority. It just says, to the extent we're going to have those taxes, and we have at least that one example now, let's have it queued up so that it is based on the administration of our Oregon personal income tax, so we do at least a good job of it.
Mr. Chair, I have a question on 2455.
2455?
Correct.
We haven't.
Representative McPherson is here on 2486 and 87. I'm your boy on 2455.
Okay. Okay.
Well, hold on one sec. You have another question on 2486 or 87?
Correct.
Okay.
Could you just describe the experience? You explained the California program as far as types of amnesties. What you're really addressing in these tax shelters is people who know they already did wrong. Is that what we're going after? Because in order to claim an amnesty, you have to know that you're eligible, and or at least they're prepared. You're one of the two.
Chair Hass, Representative Boquist, you're right that the House Bill 2486, to the extent that it is additional penalties, those stand on their own, and they can be collected at any time that we find that somebody has improperly avoided tax and they owe more, or a promoter has been peddling an abusive tax shelter. The amnesty period, that feature is does depend upon a promotion of and communication of the availability of the program. Mm-hmm. And that actually goes to a point I had intended to make earlier in my my prepared remarks, which is that the reason why these are broken into two bills, 2486 and 2487, is because 2486, there will be, it appears to me, some significant cost to implement it, in part because of the need to communicate effectively the opportunity to come in and make a filing, and that needs to go through a fiscal kind of analysis. That is, does investing that amount in the program justify what we think we're going to get out of it? And for that reason, I took the other four ideas, which even in the aggregate, I believe will not have a $50,000 fiscal impact, which is the threshold for a Ways and Means referral. Those could be considered then purely on the issue of policy. Now that question of the subsequent referral that's been placed on this to Ways and Means is something that I'll be taking up further with staff and with the Speaker's office to see whether that can be rescinded, because it's should not burden the general fund by any meaningful amount. But this 2486, I think there is a question of what we invest in communication in order to derive a certain amount of revenue.
Thank you. And my reading of the California experience, if you will, is that that education part was key to their success, in that they had hoped to raise, I think, a couple $100 million and ended up with over $1.4 billion and still counting. But education was a key part of that.
That's right, Chair Haas. It is to be a successful program, it is going to require a really good job of crafting a message, as we say in our trade, to get out to the relevant public, which are the people who've used these devices, and also convincing them we mean business. You know, if people feel like, you know, it's going to be the same kind of experience of not being pursued, you know, why go in even under an amnesty program and pay? But if the combination of demonstrating that we're building the tools to pursue tax cheats and the hammer in the form of additional penalties, but an opportunity to escape the hammer, that could be a powerful combination.
I agree. Any more questions for Representative McPherson? Okay, we'll let you get back to work.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Committee... We're also hearing 2455, and as I mentioned a moment ago, my name is on that. It is a little bit different than Representative McPherson's, although it is very similar. It does open up the amnesty a little bit, and there are some other differences, and I share the same assessment of Representative Berger about Representative McPherson's depth and eloquence on this, and I won't try to match it, but I will say that I do think that we have a responsibility in the legislature to those people who do play by the rules and pay their taxes on time, and that we have to go after the people who don't. And it's really a pretty fundamental part of government in keeping the faith in paying our taxes and playing by the rules, because when citizens see that some are not doing it, then that is encouragement for them to do the same. So to me, that's sort of the underlying principle of why I'm supporting this concept, and whether it's going to be exactly like California or not, I don't know, but I hope that we can get something into law that's close to what California did and hopefully achieve a fraction of the success that they achieved. One thing I learned during the interim when I was tasked to do this by Representative Butler is that there are amnesties and there are amnesties. California was a huge success. Louisiana was a huge disappointment. It was a flop. It was one of those situations where, as Representative McPherson mentioned, they spent more in trying to collect, and it just didn't work out. So we do have to be careful about that, but it does come with some significant obligations. One is, I do think there's going to be a cost of more people in the revenue department, and I do think there's a cost of an education component. So. We have a couple of witnesses. Before we do that, however, Paul, can you give us kind of an overview of your take on these three?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Just by way of process, to kind of let you know where the Senate is. The Senate has been looking at this language that's both in 2455 and 2486, and is crafting a bill that Dexter should have pretty much wrapped up by the end of this week. So that's Senate Bill 480. So it's very possible that could come. This issue could come to you in that form, as well as the bills before you. And there's a lot of similarities. They've used the same sorts of information. What I'd like to do is just walk through very quickly with you and address any questions you have on a little packet that I put together. It's the first page is labeled Considerations for Voluntary Compliance Initiative and General Amnesty Programs. And these are the kinds of questions that I think you have to address as policymakers in constructing a program like this. The other information in there I have, the next two pieces are from the California Franchise Tax Board website. The first is on the frequently asked questions on abusive tax shelters. And both Representative McPherson and Representative Hass referred to the California's VCI program. And then California also currently has in process right now a general amnesty program that will be running through March 31st. So they're in that process right now, and that was authorized by their 2003 legislative or 2004 legislative assembly. And then finally, there is just a list of kind of a running list that the Federation of Tax Administrators keeps on state amnesty programs going back to 1982. And you can see the states who have had general amnesty programs. There's actually 40 of them altogether. So Oregon is not on that list. And even though we have looked at it in the late 1980s, opted for an adjustment of our penalty structure at that time. And then again, we had a fair amount of discussion, of course, during the 2002 special session period, and again decided to look at other enforcement options rather than an amnesty. But I'll just go ahead and go through the kinds of questions and then highlight those that where we have had differences in how states have implemented their amnesties. First thing, in terms of who is eligible, normally what you're really trying to get at in terms of long-term revenue is the non-filers, people that have not been in the system, that not have been filing returns, because that's where you're going to get your long-run increase in revenue. Because presumably they'll continue to not file if they don't come forward. And once they do come forward, then you'll have them in the system and be able to track them. They're also very hard to get, very hard to estimate how many of them there are, and whether your particular program is going to be effective in drawing them out. One of the issues we have in Oregon, and I'll come back to this theme in a little bit, is that because we are an income tax state, we would essentially have an income tax amnesty, we have the relationship with the federal income tax, which means that most of the information that the Department of Revenue has, it will share through its agreements with the IRS. So if you are coming forward to Oregon, you've got to figure that this information, there's a good chance it will get to the IRS, and if you're not filing there, that does create a disincentive. So that is one of the issues. And, you know, I've also worked in sales tax states, and there you have a little bit different issue. The biggest compliance problem you have on sales tax often tends to be with a use tax, where you're buying some large capital equipment, for example, and there is where you can bring in some amnesty money from businesses that have a million-dollar bill or something from the previous a large purchase. So the sales tax states have been able to draw some money from that, and they don't have that federal overlap. Another issue is on current assessments and whether they're included or not. That has a huge impact on what I will do and what I'll do for the Senate bill when it goes into work session on Senate Bill 480 is I'll make an estimate of gross revenue, which would be the dollars that will come in during that period. So that would be the dollars and cents that the department would have. But then I'll also try to estimate the impact there would be on lost revenue as a result of the amnesty. And the obvious one is if you have people that you already know about and they've been in contact with, send them a notice of deficiency, Presumably, at some point in the future, they'll be paying that. If you waive penalties, for example, you would lose that penalty revenue. So that's what you'll see in our revenue impacts would be a gross amnesty dollars, a loss in revenue, and then a net figure. And what you see mostly in these numbers here that on the FDA report, for example, are usually the gross numbers, the dollars that came in that in the door. So we'll try to make sure we give you both of those and an estimate so you can have a clearest sense possible on the long-term revenue implication. The other point I wanted to raise about the eligibility is House Bill 2486 is a voluntary compliance initiative only, and 2455 has a general amnesty. The abusive tax shelter component can stand alone, as those two bills would indicate. So the abusive tax shelter got a huge lift, in my view, from the California experience simply because of the information that they are generating. And in fact, there is a package in the governor's budget for the Department of Revenue to try to use some of this information through willful avoidance of taxes. So that information is being shared with our department.
Well, I just interrupted on that point that you just raised about there's a disincentive because if the state says, look, we're going after, they have to share that information with the federal government. What was the experience in California? They have an income tax too, capital gains and all that, and they must have shared that with them.
Yes, Mr. Chair, they did. And in fact, particularly on the VCI, they emphasized that, you know, looking at their question and answer, they make it very clear that whatever information that you give us, we're going to share it with IRS. And they also turn that around and say that whatever IRS comes up with, they're going to share with us. So they use it as an efficiency argument that, particularly with abusive tax shelters, because the IRS is the one who really initiated a lot of this through their own definitions of what are listed transactions, for example. And so the California emphasis, at least in terms of the VCI, is that, you know, if one of us doesn't find you, the other will. So they'll use that as an argument to collect their revenue. But I think that's a little different from a general amnesty from a person who, you know, who's been a local person who's not reported their income over a couple of years. It's probably a different situation. So, and we haven't seen what's happening to the California general amnesty numbers yet.
Thank you.
The other thing I wanted to mention about the eligibility is if you look at both the bills you're discussing, there is some reference to IRS code, so there is some very clear definitions laid out. The key is this transactions that have no economic substance. So there that groundwork is laid. Now, the bills also give the Department of Revenue some rulemaking authority to define these transactions beyond the IRS code. So that would be, at least in my mind, a key decision to make in terms of actually deciding what goes in a bill. Because you have the IRS definitions, and then whether you want your own Department of Revenue to go a step further and use some of their discretion, that would require rulemaking on their part. Under the tax years, one of the issues that comes up, particularly in the voluntary compliance initiative, is to go back years. California went back 8 years, for example. And as we move further into the 21st century here, we're moving beyond the bubble days. Representative McPherson referred to the dot-com capital gains in the Bay Area, particularly at the, but that was really peaked in 1999 and 2000. So if you want to go back beyond our current 3 years on amended returns, you would need to go back further, either 6 or 8 years, to pick up some of those returns that during that period when the incentive was greatest. Development of either a voluntary compliance initiative or a general amnesty, what you're doing is trying to mix the carrots and sticks in a way that make it attractive enough to bring people into the system, and then after that door is closed, to ensure not only that that you give incentive for people to come forward or they'll get the stick afterwards, but also to ensure, you know, 99 point something percent of your taxpayers that are paying that they are in compliance, so that their voluntary compliance will continue in the long run. So the carrots to look at, and these can be constructed a number of ways. Obviously, penalties is the first one. We do have a set of penalties that range from 5 up to 100% if you have 3 years where you haven't reported income. Interest penalties or interest imposed on any deficient tax payments. We do have civil penalties, although they're not really used to any extent that we could determine in Oregon, but that would be something that could be at least part of the public discussion. Disclosure agreements, there are definite limitations there in terms of what the Department of Revenue can do and maintain its links with the IRS. One of the big issues that we think has influenced California is the fact that there are VCI allowed appeal rights. So that means that the taxpayer could come forward and remember with these abusive tax shelters, you're dealing with pretty sophisticated taxpayers. And so they can come forward, or their representatives can come forward and say, okay, we're going to make our payments now within the time period, but we want to retain our appeal rights. And a high percent over a majority did that. And so that, I think, does two things. One is it has a fiscal impact because you're adjudicating these decisions in some way. And then secondly, you're uncertain whether that revenue is actually going to be there when all is said and done. So that, I think, is an important decision. One of the things that did surprise me was the fact that the vast majority of these dollars came in through the personal income tax, not the corporate income tax. So,
Point on the appeals is, I guess, the question is whether people would have signed up for this if they didn't have that appeal.
Yes.
I guess no way to know for sure. But
no way to know at this time. Obviously, there's some uncertainty around, and probably some legitimate uncertainty of people who carried out some of these transactions. And so they weren't sure if it's in a gray area, and so they were, you know, protecting themselves and their clients to the extent that they could.
So on the one hand, you want to say, look, here's the deal. It's amnesty. Come clean. Mm-hmm. All bets are off. Mm-hmm. Or you say, okay, if you come clean, you still have it. You know, you just don't know.
Right. And then in the terms of the general amnesty, what California's done is that, you know, once you've signed up, once you're in the program, that's it. There's no refunds or appeals. So that was treated differently than the VCI. When is the amnesty period? That would become an important discussion, I think, with the Department of Revenue to actually implement a program as to when it fits in terms of their staff, because you do have some opportunity costs there. I mean, if they're conducting this program and they're not going to have the resources to do their normal kinds of transactions, so that needs to be coordinated. Of course, the other risk, too, if you say, I'm going to have an amnesty program down the road, then it's going to influence, you know, your collection patterns leading up to that time, right? The next list of things there, what are the sticks? Well, the sticks are kind of the reverse of the carrots in terms of penalties and interest, but post-amnesty period, and you saw the penalties that were mentioned in 2486 for the abusive tax shelters. Those would go into effect when the amnesty period is over. Couple of other things. The Department of Revenue does have a lot of flexibility, and Deborah can tell you more about that in terms of how they would actually process some of the cases of people they know that are not in compliance or have gotten a notice of deficiency. They have the discretion to look at the individual circumstances and, in effect, give an individual amnesty in terms of interest and penalty waivers. So they do have that in current statute. So I put that down as a possible stick to restrict their flexibility as a post-amnesty message. Another thing that's been suggested, and I think you'll have that from some of your public testimony, is on some type of public listing of taxpayers who are deficient. Washington, for example, Department of Revenue posts the biggest tax deficiencies by name on their website. So there's kind of a public embarrassment effect there. And then the other thing I think that comes out most clearly from, and I think you'll hear this in testimony today too, is the and what most studies say, the key for long term remains your future enforcement. You know, that if you want, you need to convince people that the amnesty is a one time or short term thing, and in the future there will be stepped up efforts so that it doesn't create some incentive down the road for either another amnesty or if they don't catch me now, they'll never catch me kind of thing. You talked a little bit, Representative Haas talked about how the knowledge of the program, how it's spread, and that does imply a fiscal impact. I should have brought it. I didn't, but I've looked at some of the literature that California is using for the current amnesty, and it's kind of a low-key approach, saying that it's titled, "Was it just an oversight?" You know, and then it says, "California needs you." And so, you know, it's not a, well, we're coming after you kind of message. And a lot of amnesties are done that way as well. So that becomes a marketing issue that can have a big effect on the ultimate impact. And then also, of course, what you do as a legislature in terms of making the public aware of it and the kind of discussions you have. Finally, the last thing is on the revenue impact. I mentioned the gross versus net, and then, of course, the ultimate long-term policy decision for you is the impact on long-term compliance, because ultimately you are, and as our chair would, I'm sure, say if he was here, it is a voluntary system. And if you lose that voluntary compliance over time, then you are going to have some real problems.
Thank you, Paul. I can just, we have two witnesses, Del Dibig and Jody Weiser. You guys want to come up together or individually? I notice in the research that I've done over the last 6 months here, a couple of threshold questions to look at are whether it's abusive tax shelters only or a more general amnesty in addition, what the penalty should be, whether they should include criminal penalties, and how much to spend on this with hopes of getting it back. So go ahead, either one.
Go ahead.
Okay. My name is Del Dibig. I'm a retired IRS agent. I worked for the IRS for 27 years until 2000, and thereafter I became an instructor for them part-time for a few years. In any case, I am interested in the tax legislation, both at the federal level and here in Oregon, with respect to the various compliance incentives that are being discussed in these bills. I've looked at the bill 2455, and one of the things that struck me in there was there were some blanks with respect to penalties as to the amount or as a percentage of income derived. And Ms. Weiser, who's a member of our group, or basically the facilitator of our group, asked why is the penalty this high. And what I've done in the written testimony I've furnished, the last page of it is an excerpt from a U.S. Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigation report with respect to the professional role of professional firms in the U.S. tax shelter industry. This one particular page has excerpts from memorandums within accounting firms discussing why they were not going to register tax shelters, and specifically they went through a cost-benefit analysis and decided that if we get caught, we'll pay the penalties and we'll still come out ahead. So in terms of the magnitude of penalties that you want to impose both on sellers, promoters, as well as advisors, make it worth somebody's while to take a look at these particular provisions. The other point, which I don't have in my written testimony, but just taking Mr. Warner's suggestion, thinking that the heydays of the tax shelters were in 99 and 2000 because of the stock market bubble and the internet bubble, my own feeling is, recollecting my experiences back in the 70s and early 80s, is that tax shelters initially are adopted by the well-to-do and the wealthy, and then they travel downstream. I think, based on what I'm seeing in current reading in the New York Times, for instance, that process is well underway, and there are probably a lot of people who are taking the handbooks of the IRS and manufacturing tax shelters, do-it-yourself tax shelters, in the form of transferring their business to Roth IRAs, making, as Mr. Warner once mentioned, making a local exempt organization or pension fund a shareholder in their subchapter S corporation, and a variety of things. There are many, many ways to basically take the tax shelters that are currently out there, and they can be put to use by just about anybody in a small business. So what you should be looking at is making sure that professionals, specifically accountants, attorneys, are not tempted to provide assistance in forming tax shelters. Another point with respect to the legislation, which Representative McPherson and Representative Haas did not specifically list in their or have in their proposed legislation in their bills, is there's a provision under federal law which relates to listed transactions. These are basically the worst of the worst tax shelters, the very abusive ones. And the reports that are required to be filed with the IRS trigger a date or trigger a time within which the IRS can assess tax. If somebody decides not to file a listed transaction or a report of a listed transaction, either as an advisor or as a seller or as a participant, the statute of limitations is open for 1 year until the IRS does receive such a report. If no report is received, the statute of limitations is open, just the way that it is when you do not file a tax return. And it's basically an open-ended statute of limitations, but I think it might be worthwhile to consider incorporating that in any compliance incentives that you have, because number one, it mirrors a federal provision under 6501C10, and it might just cause some aggravation for professionals who are intent on running the statute of limitations or delaying the Department of Revenue. Both bills 2486 and 2455 deal with the penalties, and needless to say, penalties, in my opinion, should be high so that people will take notice. Now, on Bill 2487...
Excuse me, Mr. David, would you include criminal penalties?
I would not. Number one, criminal trials are extremely expensive, and I think the IRS itself only has a few hundred each year. I, in my career, had three or four, I'm not quite sure, but it's too expensive a process to go through. I think what you want to take a look at is just confine yourself to civil penalties.
Thank you, and I won't mention that was tax evasion that eventually brought down Al Capone. It wasn't racketeering, it was tax problem.
It also brought down a vice president of the U.S. And also former IRS commissioners, believe it or not. But it's probably it's not the best way to spend money in order to get compliance, I don't think. And not something I've really thought about. Now, relative to Bill 2487, there's one provision on there which merited, in the write-up that I saw, only one sentence. It's specifically at Section 17. And I think Representative McPherson and Representative Berger are reading what is coming down the pipeline in terms of the U.S. Congress, and specifically tightening up withholding requirements with respect to those people who are not yet employees or who are basically taken off the payroll and made independent contractors. This Section 17 gives the Department of Revenue quite a bit of latitude, which if they are authorized to address withholding with respect to non-employee compensation. I believe that used judiciously, that is an extremely important provision out of all of the legislation in the three bills that I've discussed in my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Davey? Representative Berger?
I just have to say that don't credit me with with knowing what's coming down the pike on federal legislation. That's a joke. I'm speaking to the fact that
true.
Whether this provision or not is good or not, it doesn't come from my point of, from me being reading the tea leaves of federal tax law. Thank you, and thank you for you have been very active in this arena. You were in my office, and you're the one that started me, frankly, thinking about this and looking at this kind of legislation. Well, because of the work that you, both of you collectively, have done to make us aware of this whole issue of tax abuse and how it fits in our revenue picture. So I'm crediting these people with a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Tremendous.
Jody, we have your testimony up here.
Yes.
I think it's 6 pages.
I'm leaving a lot of it out. There are lines through my copy.
Reminds me when I was a reporter. So you can go ahead and read it, or we can talk about it, or whatever.
Well, I will read bits of it. Okay. I'm Jody Weiser. I'm from Portland, and I'm the facilitator for Tax Fairness Oregon. And, you know, this hearing and the law that we hope will come out of it is what we've been about for about a year now. And so it's really quite a celebration to be here in some ways. A little bit of background. I think there are two crucial things here. One is revenue. The best form of tax reform we probably have right now is to collect this 20% of our revenue that we're not collecting currently. If we put money into enforcement and they only return one-to-one, it's not cost us anything. Now, I don't expect that this is going to solve all of our revenue problems in a single year, because it takes, and Del will tell you this, it takes years to become really effective as a tax auditor. And so you're not going to get people right there right away. However, both this staff and people from around the country have told me that you can expect, generally speaking, an 8-to-1 to 10-to-1 return on investment over time. And I think that this isn't the only by enemy that we're going to be working with, so we should make the investment. The IRS no longer serves the function it used to serve. Since 1996, it is 36% smaller than it was. And it used to be that if an IRS agent went and did an audit and found that you weren't in compliance with federal law, they made sure you paid state tax, actually, before they paid federal tax, as I understand it. So with that absence, we have to make up the difference. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem, I think, that is that people have become aware that there's lack of enforcement going on, and so they're taking more chances. The governor's budget suggests a 6% departmental increase. Looking at the salaries that people are earning in the department, I don't think that's going to add very much to the workforce, and I think we need to add to the workforce. Our organization is asking that you increase their budget by 15% this year and 15% next year. Too rapid a development, it obviously would put a lot of stress there. But we do believe that stress at the Department of Revenue is better than stress in classrooms, and that's what we're facing. I would rather see a double-shifted Department of Revenue than a double-shifted classroom. A different tax base isn't nearby, and even if it were, we should be sure we're collecting fully the taxes that are already on the books. The second part of this is really not about revenue, but about integrity. There's a fairly recent research that showed over a 4-year period of time, the willingness to say it's okay to cheat on your taxes changed 7%. that's an extraordinarily rapid decline in integrity, which is was the key thing that people felt, what made them pay taxes. And I think that we have to do the enforcement work that will reverse that shift. The other big thing is there's a lot of federal figures. Like, we kept reading the $311 billion in uncollected taxes by the IRS, by their own figures. So finally I sat down one night and said, how much is that? And for Oregon, if we're just as dishonest as the IRS thinks everybody else is, how much is it? And I kept doing it, and I kept thinking I had used one too many zeros. So I gave the problem to Dell, and he came back with this figure. We're not collecting $1 billion a year. We collect in income taxes from individuals and in income and excise taxes from corporations a little over $5 billion a year. So we're really leaving a lot of money in some people's pockets. Another way to look at it is to say, if we didn't have people cheating on the taxes, on their taxes, their Oregon taxes, the rest of us would be paying $670 a year less. It's a very significant problem. The IRS figure is $2,000 a year. It's pretty easy for people to almost be proud of how do they cheat on their taxes right now, you know? I mean, you can hear people brag about their new ideas. And the newspapers and the internet and the radio are full of, here's how to cheat on your taxes. You open up any website, you Google anything like tax fairness, and there are all these ads popping up. Former IRS agents will help you evade taxes, basically. Not this one. So we have an opportunity gap that people are taking. We have an attitude gap that's hurting us. And we have simple opportunity gaps, not just big ones. I sat down with my tax forms for last year and found that 63% of my income is not verifiable or verified by the IRS or the Oregon Department of Revenue. So, that, you know, my salaries and some of that kind of stuff, my $49 and an interest from the credit union, they verify. But I have a lot of income because I have investment income, farming income, money I'm receiving from people who went bankrupt, that kind of stuff. There's no 1099s on it. In addition to that, when I sell stock, they get a report of what I sold it for. They have no report of what I bought it for. So I could say I had a loss. They wouldn't know whether I had a profit or a loss unless they do an audit. And if you're having reduction of force and increase in the number of people who are working as contractors, so their forms are going to need to be questioned more than somebody who's getting a W-2, and more people who have business entities than sub-S's and stuff like that, the forms from a sub-S corporation or an LLC are sent in. When I was a farmer, I had huge amounts of business income from farming. Guess what? The forms for that went to the departments of revenue and the IRS, but they stayed in a different room than my personal forms. So if I left off $60,000 in income, nobody was looking. They were looking at my $49 in interest at the bank, but not my $60,000 worth of farm income. I have some property for sale in California. That thing of Representative McPherson's to collect if I sell, really good idea, because Oregon would never know if I sold some property in California, would they? And California probably wouldn't either because of the ownership shift, and there's a lot of people moving around. So increased enforcement, some of which will happen in different years than this, is really important. So Tax Burns Oregon definitely supports the solutions that are before you today. We would recommend some changes. One is Representative Haas, I have to ask you if you misunderstand what's in your bill
probably.
It appears that both of you have bills that say there will be no penalties if people come forward during the amnesty. That's not what Mr. McPherson thinks his bill says. And in fact, in California, it's...
Well, I'm 2455 is mine, and his is 2486.
Yes, and his and yours, on page 6, line 5, it says there'll be no penalties during the amnesty. And on his, on page... No, I think I'm... Well, yeah, no, I think that's right. And on his, on page 12, section 24. Or I may have those in the wrong order.
Is it the six-month period, Paul? That,
I believe that's what it would be referring to, Mr. Chair, would be the
during the amnesty period, there would be no...
You're imposing these new penalties under both bills. Mm-hmm. You have the 20% penalty. So what the bill says is during the amnesty period, that penalty would not be assessed. It would be assessed after the amnesty period. So that's the carrot stick.
But that's the new penalty. But as I read it, the old penalties don't exist during that time. So I think we just need to read it and know what we're doing.
Well, I don't believe California put those new penalties.
They didn't. What they did, as I understand it, is they put the new penalties in effective the 1st of January, and they started the amnesty the 1st of January. They wouldn't apply them or any during that amnesty period if you came forward. If you didn't come forward, that was applied from that date. But that's neither here nor there. The question is really, are we giving up all penalties during the amnesty, or are we keeping current penalties during the amnesty? And we need to have that clarified, what's in this law.
Mr. Chair, that does need to be clarified, because it was my understanding under our McPherson's and my that the ordinary penalties that it would apply. It was the excess penalty during the amnesty that would be...
Okay.
Now that was my understanding. Now,
right,
whether
that's what with Representative McPherson.
That's what he said. Yeah.
And it would, but it's important that it says that.
Well, I'm just. Yeah. I don't. I'm not a lawyer. It's not what I read in the bill.
Okay.
And so that's a huge difference. It's a huge difference.
It certainly is.
Because 50% of somebody who owns $1.5 million, that's a lot of money. And they're going to want to know whether that's there or not, and you need to face that question. Now, this same question came up in doing a general amnesty in the Senate Revenue Committee, and our position is that you should never give up all penalty. Now, some people are going to owe 100% penalty. If they get rid of 90% of that, they're getting an enormous gift. But to give them 100% is kind of to say, you were a schmuck to not take the risk that I took.
I guess ultimately it just depends on where you want to create that incentive and disincentive, and there's a sweet spot in
there. Well, you have to find, yes, and you have to figure out where it is. And if the new penalty is, you know, we have a limit in our statute that says it can't be more than 100. So if you're already at 100, there's no new penalty, really. You know, so we have to look at that. Most states give up the penalty during the amnesty. Some states, believe it or not, give up half the interest during the penalty. State of South Carolina did an abusive tax shelter amnesty, and they gave up all penalties and half the interest. They hired no one new. They just said, call this number if you need to talk to us. Oh, would you like to meet with us? And would you like at our office or yours? I mean, they were just really congenial. And what they got was $8 million from 22 taxpayers who they could have gotten all of their money from, because every one of those people had already been caught by the IRS and they would have been given to them. That's not the kind of amnesty we want. We want an amnesty where people are afraid they're going to come in, they're going to pay up because they don't want it to get worse. We already have, because of California and IRS's work, if I understand right, 58 people that have come to us through the reporting mechanisms. I think we want to make sure those people don't get there, you know, a free ride out of this. So we need to make sure it's written to cover that as well. In any case, if, you know, that question is yours to decide, but we would certainly keep some penalties and all interest.
On that issue of penalties, there is one difference Representative McPherson's bill in mind, and that is penalties for tax preparers.
Yes.
California did this because of what happens a lot when people are found in abusive tax shelters. They beg off and blame the tax preparer, for which there were no criminal sanctions. So.
Yes, it's... You know, I am sure, because there's no criminal law about taxes, but there are people in Oregon who end up in criminal court about tax evasion because they're gotten for racketeering and stuff like that. And what California's people said to me was, letting all the people who are just tax preparers, and they don't sell any million-dollar deals, not have to worry about being tax preparers, was valuable to getting this accepted and getting tax preparers help. I think that does not mean that if we found someone who clearly said, oh, you don't want to pay taxes on this, I'm sending you to these people in New York City, they're going to hide it from you. Well, if there's complicity, then that isn't just being a tax preparer, that's being a tax promoter, a tax fraud promoter. And I'm sure that then they would fall under the higher penalties. And I hope that would be the case, but again, I'm not a lawyer. We think that increasing the statute of limitations such a short period of time, as is in both of these bills, is not enough. And the reason is this. If you look at the statistics from California, they started getting people from 98, 2000, 99, 2000, 2001. It started going down. Part of that's the bubble. Part of it's they didn't go back to the 1980s. There was a lot of tax sheltering being done then. Those people didn't have to come in because they were out past the statute of limitations. If we don't get this thing happening until 2006, and we say, if you don't come in, you're in trouble, but they only have to wait. They've been waiting 6 years, and they have 6 months more to go. Well, hey, I'm going to take the chance. So I think we want to give ourselves 10 years so we really have time to harvest all the information we learn. California didn't know that people were buying insurance against being audited until they did their abusive tax shelter amnesty. Well, now they're getting the records of who bought that kind of insurance. Well, you need time to do that. You don't want your statute of limitations to run out while you're harvesting information.
Does that happen up here?
Well, we won't know, but I'm sure, because the sellers of these really big things, they aren't mostly in Oregon. The people, the 22 people from South Carolina, they all got their advice from New York City, for instance. I haven't really asked that question of anybody in California. But
you bought insurance for an audit?
Pardon me?
Have you bought any of that?
No, I haven't needed to, Mark. Let's see. There's a couple more points and I'll be done. We really think you need to increase the funding for the department. And we're suggesting 15% a year. And we also think that you really need to specify just how aggressive an advertising campaign you want. Basically, what I've talked to a lot of people in California who are daily newspaper readers and have good amounts of money, so they read the business section of the paper. They have no idea what happened in their state because it was not in the local press. It was in the Wall Street Journal. It was in the New York Times. It was in the San Jose Mercury, but wasn't in, a lot of other newspapers. They found these people by sending letters to 30,000 people who had been identified in federal hearings and by other court by other cases, and they talk to the accounting firms that deal with big money clients and said, we're doing this. That's mostly what they did. They did 20 sessions of small groups. We would like to change the climate here, and that means putting up a billboard, for instance, that might say, taxpayer turns herself in, admits to using an abusive tax shelter, and has now paid $1.2 million in Oregon taxes she owed. I think that would look really nice along the road between here and in Portland, like there are other signs along the road there. I think that we need to know that it's working. That's an important thing. And I think we need signs that are in English and Spanish if we do, that we're doing a better job. And then, of course, we need to be doing a better job. A number of states, I think 12 now, do post people's names on the Internet if they are delinquent. This is not so much a shaming technique as a collecting technique because they go through a nice process before that of trying to get these people to pay their taxes during in normal ways. In Oregon, we send them to a collection agency if they haven't been paid and give up a lot of the money. This way, we send them a set of three letters and say, pay up. And a lot of them do because they're worried about the shame. They don't want to be posted there. A lot of them don't. There are a lot of names on the networks, on the internet for other states of people who haven't paid their taxes. I think that you should be receiving reports about the current levels of audits and making and the current kind of penalties that are being collected, or authorize a citizen advisory group that does monitor this so that we make sure we're getting what we want out of different things, and we should increase the percentage of audits happening in Oregon. I personally have had my income go way up and go way down. Nobody's ever asked any questions. I've forgotten to make my quarterly payments for two quarters in a row. Not a notice. Nothing happens. No, I don't have to pay a fee even for that. As long as I get my taxes paid by the time I finish doing my extensions and everything. So I think that we can tighten that up. If I don't pay my phone bill, something happens, and that needs to be happening with our taxes more, and we'll have way less people falling out of the system if we're more quick to respond if they're not staying in, or if there are huge changes in their tax behavior and we don't ask questions about. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jody, and we'll take some questions, but I do want to really salute you for your work in this. She has gone, in case other members don't know, to conferences all over the country for tax attorneys and accountants, and she has gone to learn about this. And conferences for tax attorneys and accountants. It's God's rule.
Actually, it was conferences for tax administrators. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is I'm the first tax payer that's been there. At the first one I went to, there were 13 members of Pricewaterhouse staff there. So the other side is definitely there. And they're one of the big sellers of these tax abusive
questions for
things.
Jody Weiser. A couple quick ones. Representative McPherson and I have talked about abusive tax shelter going there or amnesty or both as an approach.
I wish you had somebody before you with more experience. I've talked with some people around the country, and I can tell you that tax administrators really don't like general tax amnesties. They don't like it because they have to divert all their energy to take care of this. They don't feel it really brings in money. It brings in money faster, but you lose. Didn't you say we had how many million in 100% penalties last year? Yeah. So you give an amnesty and you give up $20 million that they would have collected. Well, that's how many you asked for but you haven't received. Yeah. You want to come up and answer? I mean, I think it's interesting
Deborah,
information.
Would you like to weigh in on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. I did just want to clarify that. Our records show that we charged $20 million in calendar year 2004, but much of that could have been canceled because some of it, at least, would be for non-filers, where we determine the tax, impose the penalty. If they then file a return that shows they actually had a refund, all of that penalty would go away. So that is the gross amount. It doesn't reflect any potential waivers.
But you know, that does speak to probably the threshold question here, which is, do you really need to pass these new laws, or do you just have the Revenue Department beef up its number and go forward enforcing the laws that are on the books, identifying these people? I mean, that really is probably the largest policy question in this whole issue.
I think it'd be really good for you to get some staff in here to talk about that. When I've talked with people, they've liked the abusive tax shelter, and not because they want to be soft on rich guys, but because it can tie them up for years in court, and they want to get it over with. They want to get, you know, they want it done. These people foolishly tried to believe that what they were doing was appropriate. It wasn't. And it's a huge hunk of money. But what I've heard is what's good about PAC shelters, amnesty periods, is it signals a change. It tells the public we're going to do something different here. And it gives people a chance to say, oops, I'm going to get caught. I'm going to get in before I get caught.
Okay. Any final questions or thoughts? Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I certainly hope this isn't the end of this discussion. This discussion has raised more questions than answers in my mind, and not the least of which, Deborah, when we talk about taxes not collected, we're trying to measure something that doesn't exist in a way, and then to measure that against the cost of collection. And we went through a lot of this last session. There was a lot of discussion, and we went to collections, and I would, for one, like a lot more information on how we're doing in terms of where we were 2 years ago in terms of this. And I also think, and I'll be honest with you, that I was here 2 years ago when we talked about the tobacco taxes and the collections, and we invested in that, and frankly, our experience was not encouraging. And so with that as a recent example, I'm going to ask a lot more questions before we go out and beat this drum in terms of reinvesting or more investment in collections. But I do see, and that's why my name is on here, that there are things going on in other states and specific places where we could be more aggressive, and we need to kind of to be a little strategic and say, what are they? How can we measure success? And what are the investments to get us there? And these are the questions that I want to have answered in this process specifically. I would also tell you that I'm very sensitive to the fact that, for instance, Jody's correct, a lot of us sort of go, oh, yeah, I cheated the IRS or I cheated the tax collector on my when I filled out this form. And I would say in most cases it wasn't cheating at all. It was that form was so darn difficult. I didn't know how to fill it out. I literally took a dart, threw it at it, and said, okay, let them come and get me if they don't like it. And that is our problem collectively. We have made our tax collections such a nightmare for all concerned. And certainly the IRS and the federal government call Congress the bad boys, call us the bad boys for what we do in the state of Oregon. We have actually promoted, I believe, low-level checks, cheating, if you want to call it that, by the complexity of our collection method. And so we need to beat ourselves with that stick. We're guilty, too. Every time we come up with some scheme that does this and then does that and then ends up with another line on a tax form. So that is my great speech on this subject. And I hope, Mr. Warner, that we will see at some point a comparison between what the Senate bill does, what these bills do, and be able to make some clear policy decisions as a committee and as a body on which way we want to go. And I don't know how to make that happen, but that's what I desire.
Thank you.
Okay.
And I would invite you, if you want to vent those hostilities, we do have an IRS agent here.
Well, it's not.
I'm a constituent.
Yeah. He's a constituent. Right.
I share in some of that same sentiment, Representative. But still, it goes back to what we talked about earlier, that there is a responsibility here to the people who do pay on time and play by the rules. For those who don't play by the rules, the burden on those that do is greater.
Absolutely.
And I think, Jody, you said that even if it comes out as a wash, I think there's some public good there. Not that that's our goal, but okay. So no other witnesses. We the Revenue Committee stands adjourned.
Paul.